For those of you that are visiting this morning, there's about four or five of you, I guess. This is a class on the biblical foundations of American history. And we're trying to draw some correlation between what has happened in America and America's either following God's law or rejecting God's law. And we basically have come to the place of the Civil War. At the time of the Civil War in 1861, it was pretty much an accepted ideal by probably the vast majority of people in the United States that slavery was wrong, not only wrong, but immoral. You'll find very little written concerning slavery prior to 1860, 1858, and through there that did not recognize slavery as an immoral institution, although you don't have to go quite that far in the history of America. Jefferson, Washington, Adams, all of those individuals spoke out against slavery. And even in the South, slavery was acknowledged as wrong and immoral. So you don't have much of a problem along that line as you read the writings prior to the Civil War. The problem in that really produced the Civil War was, how do you rid yourself of this institution? How do you get rid of it? And what measures do you take? What steps do you take? How does a country rid itself of a situation that is wrong, although, and even though it's wrong, it's been practiced for almost, from 1870, almost 100 years. It had been accepted as a practice. And to try and get you to understand what is going on, sometimes we make the Civil War wrong ideals. Okay, the Civil War was not fought over slavery, and I'll show you that this morning as we get to it. But the problem in the Civil War, if you want to get it in modern terminology, would be like this. And I've used this before, but please, if you'll think about it, you'll get an idea of what the Southern states faced. If tomorrow afternoon the United States Congress in both houses and the President were to sign it all in one day, were to ratify a piece of legislation that said it was now illegal under the federal guidelines and the federal law of the United States for automotive workers to employ anyone under the age of 50 years of age, what would happen to the auto industry? All right. You have an idea of what kind of repercussions that would cause throughout the auto industry. You'd basically cripple the largest institution in the United States. Think of how many people would suffer because of that. And that basically, if you can get that thought into your mind, is what the South is facing as a result of getting rid of slavery. Now again, they don't try to justify it on moral grounds. Nobody's trying to do that in 1861. Nobody's trying to say, well, you know, God gave us these slaves and therefore they're ours. And that's not true. Most of the people, there were only 6,000 plantation owners at the beginning of the Civil War. There were 6,000 people in the South that owned slavery, owned slaves. And but you're looking at an institution to take it away overnight would have been to decimate the South and its economy and basically destroy its whole financial base. So the problem became, not do we get rid of slavery, but how do we go about doing it? Lincoln, I've got several writings here. I'm not going to be able to read these. I think I've got about 75 sheets this morning with stuff on it to read. Obviously, I won't be able to do all that. Lincoln's initial proposal was for a 35-year plan to eliminate slavery. All right. Had the South taken Lincoln on his proposal, they would have fared much, much better than they did. Lincoln's proposal, before he was even put in office, was a 35-year plan, obviously from 1860, 1865, right up through the turn of the century is what he was looking at, a proposal that would have ridded the country of slavery and also would have provided for the South, because in so doing, what he proposed to do was that each slave on their 18th birthday or whatever the age range was would be turned loose and allowed to go free, and each slave that a southern plantation owner released for freedom, he would be recompensed from the federal government. He'd be given a financial bonus to help him overcome and offset the loss that he would incur. And to be honest with you, it's an excellent plan. And the South basically was nuts for not going for that plan, because that would have, in essence, cushioned the blow and helped rid themselves of the institution of slavery. The problem came in not because they didn't want to get rid of slavery, but because Lincoln then wanted to turn around and restrict, or I say Lincoln, but the Democratic Party wanted to, or the Republican Party wanted to restrict the growth of the institution of slavery in the rest of the nation. Now realize, if you will, at the time of the 1860s, the majority of land to the west of the Mississippi River is unsettled land as far as statehood is concerned. There's maybe three or four states that exist there, but the majority of that land, the Nebraska Territory, the Oklahoma Territory, the Colorado Territory, all of those places are just territory. And there is no statehood there. There are no states that exist there. And the idea of the Republicans at that point was, we can't allow slavery to extend itself into these newly formed states if we have any design at all of eliminating it from our country, which was a right idea. The problem came down to this. It was a test of the constitutional power of the federal government over the states' rights. Does the federal government have the power to overrule the states and say, I'm sorry, state, no matter what you want, no matter what your desire is, you simply cannot do that. We won't allow you to do that. And so the problem was very heated and obviously led to war in the end, because who makes that call? Does the federal government have that power? Well, we know now, in 1995, that it does have that power. And how does it get that power? It got that power as a result of its victory in 1865. Up to that point, very few people would admit that it had that power. Let me read to you, give you an idea of the changes that were taking place back here, if I can find this. Spent a lot of time with Mr. Lincoln over the last few weeks. And the resolution that he signed back in 1837 while still in power in Illinois, I believe. Well, thought I'd read it to you. There you go. This was signed, Protest of Representative Stone and Lincoln in the Illinois legislature against certain pro-slavery resolutions of that body. This is a resolution proposed by Lincoln and Stone in the Illinois legislature in 1837. And I just read a couple of paragraphs about why they were opposed to the steps that this pro-slavery people were taking. Number one, they believe that the Congress of the United States has no power under the Constitution to interfere with the institutions of slavery in the different states. They believe that the Congress of the United States has power under the Constitution to abolish slavery in the District of Columbia, but that the power ought not to be exercised unless at the request of the people of the district. Now, that's what Lincoln and Stone believed. That the federal government didn't have that power. Lincoln changed in the process of time and believed that the federal government did have that power. So in 1837, a lot of people had its belief that the federal government did not have that kind of power. And again, it's back to the same old resolution we talked about, or the issue we talked about, of the anti-federalists versus the federalists. And Jefferson was an anti-federalist and believed that the federal government was a mistake. The strong federal government was an absolute disaster. And Jefferson believed that the states, and more particularly the people in those states, had the right to make that determination. Now, the irony of all this, okay, the big fight about the states' rights and the people versus the federal government, the big irony of all of it is, if the thing of the issue of slavery had gone to a referendum. What's a referendum mean? A recall, or the people of the United States make the vote. All right, if you've got an issue in Congress and somebody calls for a national referendum, what they're saying is, let's let the people vote on this themselves. If the ideal had gone to a national vote, slavery would have been voted out hands down. There's no way slavery would have made, because not just the majority, but the vast majority of the peoples in the United States of America were opposed to the institution of slavery. And so the squabble, the fight really was unnecessary. But the states began to get upset. The states said the federal government does not have that right. And their fear was not slavery. Their fear was, if the federal government assumes this power to lord over the states, who will draw the line as to where they stop? Will they have a right then to someday tell us what type of school buses we have to haul our children to school in? Yes, they do. Will they someday have a right to tell us what subjects we have to teach in our classrooms and how much money we have to spend on each? Yes, they do. Will they someday control all of our roads and highways? Yes, they will. And so what the southern states feared has actually become a reality. And up until this last election basically was the same issue. You're right back, I believe history goes in circles. You're right back to just about 1860 right now, as far as the attitude in this country is. And the attitude is, who runs the show, the federal government or the states? And if you watch any of the polls, and I don't know that you can trust the polls, but it seems to indicate that the vast majority of people believe that the strongest power of the government should rest in the hands of the states, rather than in that of the federal government. So you're right back where it was again. Now, I hope it doesn't lead to a civil war. I don't think that it needs to, but we're right back to that ideal again. And so as soon as Lincoln is elected president, Lincoln is the Republican candidate. He stands on the Republican platform, which meant two things. Number one, there was not going to be any expansion of slavery into the territories by order of the federal government. And number two, that the institution of slavery was doomed, and somewhere there's going to have to be an agreement hammered out as to how slavery was going to be eliminated. It was those two things, basically, and number one, primarily, that got the South a little irate. The war begins shortly after Lincoln's inauguration. As a matter of fact, several of the states have seceded from the Union before Lincoln is even sworn in. Back then, a fellow was elected in November, and he wasn't even sworn in until the following March. Now it's January. But Lincoln had scarcely been elected for even a month. In December, states began to secede from the Union. And the question then became, now the federal government professes to have the power to tell territories they cannot impose slavery in their territories. Does the federal government have the power to tell a state that it cannot secede from the Union? You see, it's all a test of federal versus state. And so the great crime of the southern states was to secede from the Union. All right, I'll give you an idea here and try to very quickly of how things transpire. And again, you have to bear with me. The objectives of the North and the South at the beginning of the Civil War were pretty easily explained. If you look at these maps right here, Washington, D.C. and is right up in, I'm trying to look at my map, let me look here, it'd be easier, all right, right in through here in Maryland is where Washington, D.C. is. And if you come across the river there, the Potomac, and traverse the probably 50, 60 miles, you'll come to Richmond, Virginia, which was the capital at that time of the Confederacy. So both capitals very near one another. And the objective of the North is we go down, we capture Richmond, end of story. Okay, end of battle, it's all over with. And the majority of the northern troops that signed up, matter of fact, close to 90% of the northern troops that signed up for service in the war signed up for 30 days. I'll give you an idea how fast they thought this thing would be over. They didn't believe it would last very long. Why? Well, I'll give you an idea. As far as population breakdown, I'll give you the North versus the South. 70% of the American population lived in the North. 30% lived in the South. Land area, the North composed itself of 76% of all the land in the United States, Northern Territory, 24% for the South. Railroad mileage, 71% was in the North, 29% was in the South. Number of factories, 86% of all factories were in the North, 14% were in the South. Industrial workers, 92% of all industrial workers were in the North, 8% were in the South. Value of dollar value of farmland, 72% of all the worth farmland of the worth of the farmland was in the North, 28% in the South. Value of livestock, 60% of the value of livestock was found in the North, 35% in the South. There's just an overwhelming overwhelmingly an obvious advantage to the North over the South. And so the North, very confident, they believed this was not going to be a long battle. This was going to be a very quick battle. It was going to end very quickly. It was going to be over. And they decide, 30 days is plenty long enough to enlist. We'll go down here. We'll take Richmond. End of battle. The only problem is that as they begin to move their way south, and of course McDowell is in command of the Union troops, it really took the Union Army 4 years to come up with a commanding general. And McDowell is in charge, and McDowell heads down to a little place called Manassas Junction over into Virginia, and the idea was there they'd set up their battle, there'd be a crushing victory for the North, and then the South would have to capitulate, Richmond would fall, and the end of the war would be there. It was such an obvious advantage that when the Battle of Manassas Junction was fought, there were actually spectators that traveled from Washington, D.C., you know, little Surreys with a fringe on top, they followed along behind the Union Army because they're going to go down and watch it. They thought, you know, how bad could it be? We go down here, watch this little skirmish, few shots fired, end of story. And so there were several hundred spectators that followed along behind the Union Army and to watch this battle down at Manassas Junction. That battle became known as the Battle of Bull Run. And if you know anything about the Battle of Bull Run, you know that it was one of the worst humiliations the North ever suffered. It did not take very long at all until the South showed an obvious advantage in that battle, so much so that the Northern troops ran from the battlefield, dropped their weapons, dropped their flag, and ran from the battlefield so hurriedly that they trampled to death about half of the spectators. And so, you know, what appeared to be a very quick, short battle was, you know, obviously not to be. And probably put some question mark on McDowell's future to command the Union Army, so much so that McClellan was put in charge of the Union Army shortly after that. McClellan's idea also was to take Richmond. He was turned back. It seemed like for the first 2 years of the war, everything goes to the favor of the South. But the South's objective was this. Obviously, the South was outnumbered. Obviously, the South did not have the ability to withstand a long, drawn-out campaign. And the South's objective in this war was to win, but they knew they had to win quickly. They knew they could not withstand the onslaught of several years' warfare. Obviously, they did not have. The South actually went into the war better prepared than the North. They had better uniforms. I mean, they were just better prepared because they were ready to fight. When they withdrew from the Union, they knew a fight was going to ensue, at least most of them. And they were prepared for it. What they weren't prepared for was 4 years of war. They were not ready for that. As a matter of fact, when most of the plantation owners and plantation workers marched off to war, their slaves remained behind and farmed the land. They figured they were going to march up there, quick battles, quick victories, and they were going to win. And although they were victorious in the first couple of years, there were two battles of Bull Run, and they won both of them. There were battles all along down through here. Let's run down through it for a minute. We'll give you an idea of where things go. Let's see here. The Battle of Bull Run is fought in February of 1862. And McDowell is replaced by McClellan, and McClellan makes an incursion into the country of the state of Virginia, and he's turned back. The second Battle of Bull Run is fought in August of 1862. The North loses. In September of 1862, McClellan is still, this is McClellan's forte, he marches to Antietam. And Antietam is just up north of the line into Maryland. Let me see if I can get this here. That's not going to work either. If I come out here, there you go. Antietam is just up across the line there where Virginia, the dark gray, and Maryland are. And Lee takes his forces. Lee, knowing he has to have a quick battle, quick victory, attacks in the north. That was one of the mistakes the South made. Every time they went into the north, they had problems. And Lee takes his troops up into the north, crosses the line over into here, and he's met by McClellan, and the Battle of Antietam ensues. The Battle of Antietam is the costliest battle ever fought on American soil. A one-day total of 22,000 casualties. That's 22,000 individuals killed or wounded in 1 day. You can imagine what kind of a battle that is. And at the end of the day, really, to be honest with you, there was no decided victory at Antietam. It's not a battle that the South lost, nor is it a battle that they won. There's about 11,000 casualties on each side. The problem was that Lee realized he could not maintain that type of loss very much longer. He realized his supply line couldn't keep up the ammunition required. He realized he didn't have the men to put out 11,000 men a day. And so Lee was forced to retreat back across the river. However, as a result of Antietam, McClellan is replaced by General Burnside. And General Burnside, you probably are very familiar with General Burnside, especially if you grew up in the 60s. His namesake, he was known for his big handlebar mustache that stuck way out, and also his long growth of hair on the side of his face, which later on became known as sideburns, from Burnside. That's exactly where they came from. And Burnside assumes command of the Union Army. And Burnside again begins to push the battle, and Burnside decides a frontal assault at Fredericksburg would be in his best interest. And in December of 1862, he attacks it to Fredericksburg. There are 10,000 Confederate casualties at the Battle of Fredericksburg. 10,000 Confederate casualties, but the North is turned back again. The North is not able to secure a foothold in the South. These fellows mean business. Now, you know, we talk about 10,000 and 11,000. You've got to get an idea how many people that is. That would be, I guess, probably synonymous with everybody from here to the mall dying in a day. That's quite a loss. And these individuals are willing to fight that battle and to make those to have those losses because of their cause, because of what they wanted to see. And so the battles are not going very well at all for the North. However, in the West, and again, these little lines drawn here are basically the battles that took place in the West, and we'll show you there. There's a fellow over in the West, and his name is Grant. And Grant is... Along about the middle of 1862, their strategy changes, and their idea, if you'll notice, several states of the Confederacy are here west of the Mississippi, several states are east. Their idea is if they can control the Mississippi, they have effectively cut the South in half. And so the battle begins to press down from really Cairo, Illinois, and presses on down through into Tennessee, where Tennessee begins to fall. Shiloh is fought. You've heard of the Battle of Shiloh. Shiloh is fought in April of 1862, and it is a victory for the North. And from Shiloh, they march on Memphis, and in June of 1862, Memphis falls. Down and through there, eastern Tennessee, you'll find a lot of Union remainder there. I preached a meeting several years ago in Union City, Tennessee. Give you an idea of why it was called Union City. It was one of the first places the Union began to get a hold down through there. From there, Grant takes his men down into Georgia and then moves back up into Tennessee, crosses the Mississippi, comes down the western side of the Mississippi, down to a place there called Fredericksburg. And it is at Fredericksburg that Grant begins to bog down a little bit. Fredericksburg was one of the strongest cities that the South had on the Mississippi River. It's that little white dot right there, if I can get to it, inside that little circle. And Fredericksburg is assaulted. Grant bogs down. He just can't seem to take the city. And it's heavily fortified, it's heavily protected, and the South is entrenched there. It was at Fredericksburg that the Union shelling started. I've mentioned to you several weeks ago, they shelled for 6 weeks straight and nearly leveled the city at Fredericksburg. Finally, it is closer to the fall when Fredericksburg capitulates and Grant moves his troops into Fredericksburg, actually comes over as far as Jackson, Mississippi, which is the other little white dot, takes Jackson, Mississippi, and then begins to advance back up northward along the Mississippi River, back toward the east, across the states of Tennessee, Mississippi, and Alabama, and finally comes up there to that little dot where the black line ends, and that's a little place called Chattanooga. And that's where the Battle of Chattanooga will ensue right there. But the North is victorious in the West. Now, you see what they've done? They've cut the South in half. What that means is anybody that wants to secure a path across here cannot do it. You've got Admiral Farragut here coming up from New Orleans. He actually comes up the Mississippi with his gunboats and takes south of Fredericksburg everything that Grant doesn't get. So they basically control all of the Mississippi Basin. And it is Farragut that comes in from the south. It is Grant that comes down from the north and cuts the Confederacy in half. And what that means, obviously, divide and conquer. That's a good strategy. And anytime you can divide your enemy in half, you've got an advantage. And so Grant was successful in doing that. He moves on to Chattanooga. And it is at Chattanooga that the entrenchments begin again and the battle is to be fought. It takes almost a year. In 1863, in June of 1863, an event turns here back in the east, which turns things around. Lee now has been fighting for 2+ years. And as a matter of fact, if you watch the battle movements of Robert E. Lee, he fights in Virginia alone. And that's one of the reasons Lee fought for the South. He said he wanted to protect the honor of Virginia. And Lee crosses into Maryland 2 different times, and neither time wins a victory. He's victorious on Virginia soil when he fights. He fought for the honor of his state, and believe what he fought in. But Lee makes another fateful decision in 1863. Middle of that year, he decides again, if we're going to be victorious, we've got to go up here. We've got to be victorious in the North. We've got to show them that we can win in the North. And hopefully, what Lee was wanting to do, the Union Army is bogged down here at Chattanooga. And Lee attempts to convince the North that trying to keep pumping the war materials into the South is in vain. He wants to discourage the morale of the North. So he marches across the Potomac River and up into the North. And by now, there's a fellow up there by the name of George Meade, who is in command of the Union troops. And Meade and Lee run together at a little town up there into Pennsylvania, several, not very far at all, from the capital of the United States. And that place is a little town called Gettysburg. And it is at Gettysburg where some believe that Lee made probably his only mistake of the Civil War. And had Lee chosen not to fight at Gettysburg, the whole thing may have come out entirely different. Nobody's to know. All we can do is hindsight at this time. But Lee is a gentleman. And it's called noblesse oblige. He believes in the obligation to be noble. It's required in life to have some character and some nobility. And when Lee moves up there to Gettysburg and Meade's troops begin to entrench themselves, there are several mountains there called Little Round Top, Big Round Top. And obviously in a battle such as this, to hold the high ground is a great strategy. In this day and age of air warfare and missiles launched, you know, several hundred miles away, it really doesn't matter where you're at. But in these days, to hold the high ground is to hold the advantage. And, of course, the North had the advantage. They saw Lee coming, they saw his approach, and they entrenched themselves there just to the east of Gettysburg on Big Round Top, Little Round Top. They set themselves in array, and it was actually a unit of cavalry that first intercepted Lee's men, and they set up a stronghold or a front line that held long enough for the infantry to get in behind them from the North and to secure those positions. It was Longstreet, I believe, if I'm not mistaken. It was General Longstreet that had a conversation with Lee, and Lee decided not to take his advice. And because of that, some have indicated that Longstreet basically refused to fight, and because of that, the South lost. There's no substantiation to that. But Longstreet was one of Lee's finest generals. And Longstreet said to Lee, "You've got the North here. They're entrenched. They're set up. They own the high ground." And he said, "Let's go around them. Let's not fight them, let's go around them." He said, "We can go around them and then we'll be between them and their capital. And they'll have to fight through us to get to their capital." And Lee, in his whatever nobility, said something to the effect of, "These fellows have worked this hard to come and set up this battle, and what kind of a gentleman would I be if I didn't give them a battle?" That was Lee's ideology. And 3 days of fighting there at the Battle of Gettysburg cost a total of 52,000 American casualties on North and South. 52,000 casualties in 3 days of fighting at Gettysburg. And in 3 days fighting at Gettysburg, Lee never got an advantage. Lee's cavalry never got in place. Lee's cavalry was somewhere up in Pennsylvania raiding the enemy. Had he had his cavalry again, maybe a different story. Lee didn't have any cavalry. He relied on his artillery and his infantry to fight the battle, and you never knock people off a high position with artillery and cavalry or infantry alone. It requires the cavalry. That's your horseback soldiers. And so after 3 days, Lee is forced to withdraw again, and that is a major defeat for Robert E. Lee. And so that takes place in June. What is interesting is that in the same month, early July, Chattanooga falls. So you got back-to-back problems. And really, I guess it was June of 1863 that turned the whole thing around. And because of the victory there at Chattanooga for Grant, he is immediately brought to Washington, where he's placed in charge of the eastern part of the troops that are fighting for Lincoln and the northern states. But by then, the handwriting is on the wall. The South literally has already lost the war. They just don't know it yet. There are still a number of victories to come, however. Hooker has lost in Chancellorsville, and again, here's several. You can find people that write tell you why the South lost the Civil War. One is Lee's persistence in fighting in Gettysburg. One is Grant's taking Chattanooga. And another one comes a little earlier than that at a place called Chancellorsville. Again, Chancellorsville is in Virginia, and it was a southern victory. This is before Gettysburg was fought. It was a great victory for the South again. They turned back the Union troops, and Hooker is in charge at Chancellorsville. He's the commander just prior to Meade, just prior to Gettysburg. But something takes place at Chancellorsville that Robert E. Lee will ever acknowledge as one of the darkest days of his career. And it was at Chancellorsville where Stonewall Jackson has heard that there's a skirmish going on. He rides out to appraise the situation. And when he does, he's caught either in an ambush or at least an attack. And he and his men turn to flee. And as they come back to their own lines, their own men open up on them. And he is killed. And Stonewall Jackson is killed by his own troops. And Lee said, "I've lost my right arm." He said, "I don't have anybody else that can do what that man can do." We read to you the testimony of Stonewall Jackson several weeks ago. Stonewall Jackson, probably one of the greatest Christians that there was in the time of the Civil War. He was called a radical, fanatical Christian. And Stonewall Jackson loved the Lord before the Civil War and during the Civil War to the time of his death. It was Jackson, when he was on his deathbed there in the tent, he was delirious for some hours. He really wasn't injured too badly, it appeared. But evidently the infection or whatever set in and claimed his life. During the last few hours of his life, he was delirious, and the whole time he was in command of some imaginary battle. He was ordering the infantry to move here, and he was ordering the generals to move their troops here and there, and he was pushing the victory on. And they say you can hear him even outside the tent as he ordered the troops around, trying to get them in place for this imaginary battle that he was fighting. And finally, just as his last words were leaving his mouth, he said something about, "Let's move into the battle," and then he said, "No." And he stopped for a minute and he said, "Let's go over there across the river and rest under the shade of those trees." And died. That's where he passed away and was gone. And evidently he changed from the battlefield to some other kind of scene that he saw and decided to leave the war. But that always would affect Lee and was the great cause of his discouragement. So somewhere along the line there, people would say, here's where the South lost the Civil War. Either they didn't get the quick victory they wanted, or else it was because they lost Chattanooga, or else it was because Lee stayed and fought at Gettysburg when he shouldn't have, or else it was because they lost Stonewall Jackson at the Battle of Chancellorsville. Obviously, when you go through a battle, there's always people that sit down for years and write the whys and wherefores. I don't know that you ever would know why things took place. But notice, if you will, this little white line that extends here from Chattanooga on across. And that was General Sherman. And Sherman in his faithful march to the sea. Here's an important ideal. The South basically is done at this point. When Gettysburg falls, it's not a problem at all for Grant. Finally, they end up down in Appomattox Courthouse here in April. And again, you're talking July. In August of one year, by April of the next year, everything's done. The battle is over. It's ended. And however, here's where your southern hatred begins. I told you the other day, I was in a sensitivity training class at the Peace Officer Training Academy this week down in London, Ohio. And a lot of the hatred that was found in the South for the black, and I'm not going to deny that it was there, a lot of that racial stuff did not come as a result of being pro-slavery. I said to you before, most of the people in the United States would have admitted to you that slavery was immoral and wrong. You ever wonder, well, you know, how did the South get such a reputation for hating black people? The reputation the South had for hating black people, and if that be so, and I'll be honest with you, I don't think it's just confined to the South at all. I think the Northerners like to make a big do out of it. Was not a hatred for the black race at all. It was a hatred for the North. And that hatred's still there. How many Southerners have I got in here this morning? Anybody willing to admit it? Does the South hate the North to this day? You better believe they do. You know, you buy the hats down there, the South will rise again. There is a bitter hatred for the North to this day. And if you go down there and talk very much, you're still a Yankee if you're down there. I mean, you might as well admit it. They're going to identify you in 10 or 15 minutes. And I guess that doesn't work just one side. I have people all the time tell me, well, you're a Southerner, aren't you? Well, what are you, a bigot? You know, if it works one way, shouldn't it work both ways? What do you mean I'm a Southerner? But it's what begins to take place right now in June, July, and August of 1863 that is going to forever put a hatred in the heart of the South. And one of them is Sherman's March to the Sea. And Sherman decides after the fall of Chattanooga that he is going to again, notice if you will, they've cut the South in half this way. And now the decision is we can cut the South in half this way. Yeah, if I don't knock the map off the board here. Again, we can divide the South again. And so Sherman leaves Chattanooga and makes his way basically down along the state line of Georgia and Alabama, and then moves over to the east and takes Atlanta and literally burns Atlanta to the ground. It is one thing to be victorious. It is another thing to be cruel. And what Sherman's March to the Sea, now if you read a northern writer, and I've read them, they say, boy, it was Sherman's March that really humiliated the South and brought about the quick end of the war. If you read a southerner will tell you that it was Sherman that was cruel and heartless and raped and killed and his soldiers stole as they moved across there. They said the war went from a war of honor to a war of dishonor. And they moved toward the South, they burned Atlanta to the ground, and I mean, people died. You're not talking about soldiers anymore. You're talking about the city, the soldiers moved out from around Atlanta, Sherman marched in, the city was set on fire and burned to the ground. No soldiers there. Women and children, elderly people, that's all that was in Atlanta. He from there leaves and moves on to Savannah, Georgia, which is on the coast, and again, the account takes care of itself. He literally burned a swath as he marched down through the South, and there's where the beginning, the seeds of your Southern hatred occur. It was in what Sherman had done. You don't find Lincoln saying too much to the credit of Sherman. I don't even think Lincoln appreciated what Sherman did. And we'll talk about that a little later on when we get to Reconstruction, but you're going to find that that's number one of the reasons the South has a hatred. Even in Gettysburg, when the Northerners and the Southerners met, they didn't fight in the town. They went off to the side. They knew you don't upset people's livelihood for the sake of a war. And there was a war fought with honor. They would have a battlefield, and it was to the east of Gettysburg. The city basically, I'm sure, suffered some loss, but it was not burned to the ground or destroyed. That was not their intent in that war. But for some reason, mid-1863, the intent of the war became to destroy and to demoralize through destruction. And so Sherman's march to the sea. Now notice, once he reaches Savannah, he turns north, and he takes the capital of South Carolina, and then moves on up as far as Raleigh, North Carolina, and effectively pins Lee in between Grant and himself. They've got him surrounded, and Appomattox Courthouse is right there in Virginia. Lee knows he's surrounded, he knows he can't go anywhere, and he knows the battle is lost. The war ends, and the treaty is signed. But, I mean, this is a very, very quick overview. I'm not trying to give you all the specifics and the details. But understand again, in 1863 there, the war takes a turn for the South. And the South now feels like they were invaded and destroyed. And Lincoln, at the end of the war, let's go ahead and move on there just for a little bit. Maybe we can, I'd like to read you several things here, but I will wait on this. At the conclusion of the war, Lincoln's call is for forgiveness and rebuilding, restoration. Lincoln's design is to go in now to help the South, to replenish the South, to give them back the things that they've lost, to bring them back into the Union, yes, but to make them productive states again. And if you read Lincoln's plan of Reconstruction, you'll realize that none of it was ever carried out. Lincoln's plan of Reconstruction was not followed at all. And of course, Lincoln is assassinated just a few weeks following the signing of the treaty there. And everything is over with. The battle has run its course, and now Lincoln is dead. And Lincoln's vice president is placed in power. Anybody know who his vice president was? Johnson. Johnson is in power, and Johnson turns out to be a tyrant. Johnson not only wants to lord it over the South, but he wants to control the South. There's where you get the term. Have you ever heard of the carpetbaggers? All right. The carpetbaggers are placed in control of the South by and large, and they are northern financiers and businessmen who just by lot of their wealth are given control over cities and businesses in the South. The owners of those businesses are kicked out as being unpatriotic or Southern collaborators or whatever, and their businesses, the businesses they've worked for a lifetime to build, are now turned over to the hands of Northerners. How do you think that appeals to the South? Sherman has marched through and burned the swath through the whole South, and now the businesses are given over to the Northern control. And not only that, but the slaves are set free. All right, you say, well, the South rebelled against that. The problem was the slaves were set free, and you're talking several millions of slaves with no provision on how to feed them, where to shelter them, or how to employ them. Do you see a problem? The problem arose in the South now. Those slaves weren't in the North, where 91% of the industry was. Those slaves were in the South. And now no one is there to feed them. No one is there to clothe them. What happens? You begin to get instances of looting and pillage. Not to blame them. What else are they going to do? What else are they going to do? The North, to the dismay of the South and the protest of the South, gives all of the slaves the right to bear arms. So now you've got people that are hungry, have no place to sleep, need to take care of their family with a loaded weapon. What is going to ensue? All right, there's where your Ku Klux Klan begins to arise. And I am not a supporter of the Ku Klux Klan. But I will admit to you that when it arose, it probably was something the South felt necessary. And because all at once they were not in control of their own land anymore, they were not in control of their own states anymore, and they did not have the wherewithal to take care of all the people that needed to be taken care of. And so Reconstruction, basically, if you want to write this period down, Reconstruction turns out to be a disaster. It is Reconstruction that forever separated the North from the South. And if you study the Civil War, you'll find out at these great battles, Gettysburg and Chancellorsville and these other places, there were generals on either side, North and South, that would sit down and have lunch together while the battle was going on. It was a war of honor. These men never looked at themselves as haters of the North or haters of the South. They looked at themselves as defenders of their own states. And although they had different viewpoints politically, there was a tea held the first day of Gettysburg when the generals got together and had an afternoon tea session. Most of them had been to school together. They'd been to West Point together. Some of them were brothers against brothers. But following Sherman's march to the South, there begins to be some hatred that probably will never be extinguished. And it was caused because of the needless destruction. Lincoln had a plan in existence to take care of the slaves, to provide for the slaves, to help the South out. But Johnson would have none of that. And so the occupation of the North and South is still a very bitter topic between peoples of the South. For instance, you find peoples of the South to this day vote Democrat no matter who's on the ticket. I have an uncle, he doesn't even care who's running. He just goes in and pulls the lever for the Democratic side. Say, why would he do that? Lincoln was a Republican. Johnson was a Republican. They don't care who's, as long as it's not a Republican, they don't care who runs this country. And so you say, where in the world does that come from? Well, you say it's an old-fashioned bigotry and it's all this. But I tell you what it was, those people still remember. See, you're only three generations removed from the Civil War. You're only three generations removed from the Civil War, and some of those people some of those people don't forget very easily. All right, let me read you. I got about 5 minutes here. A couple of things about some of these individuals. There were good men on both sides. I would say that if the South had an advantage, it was in its leadership. The leadership of the Southern armies was couldn't even be compared to. When Ulysses S. Grant finally assumes control of the Northern armies, you know, he's pushed as being a great commander, but basically he earned his reputation here in the West. There wasn't much major fighting going on in the West. Had Grant been over here facing Lee along with some of these other fellows, Grant would probably met his demise along with the rest of them. Lee was a tough general to contend with, and Grant never faced Lee till Lee had already been defeated at Gettysburg and demoralized. And had it been differently, Sherman nor Grant, probably both of them put together, couldn't have had any effect on Lee. Lee was a great general. He was a great Christian man. And again, Lee was acknowledged as being a fanatical Christian. Whenever they say fanatical Christian, you got an idea it's your kind. By that I mean soul winner, you know, love the Bible, that type of stuff. And note here that says, to understand the faith of Robert E. Lee is to fill out the picture of him as a gentleman of simple soul. For him, religion blended the code of noblesse oblige. There it is, that obligation to be noble. You don't have that Christian anymore. You don't have it in pulpits anymore. An idea to be a gentleman. Nobody has a reason not to be a gentleman. And I say that from whosoever side you're on. Together, these two forces resolved every problem of his life into right and wrong. There cannot be said to have been a secret of his life, but this assuredly was the great transparent truth, and this it was primarily that gave to his career its consistency and decision. Over his movements as a soldier, he hesitated often, but over his acts as a man, never. There was but one question ever: what was his duty as a Christian and a gentleman? You'll find that in his writings over and over and over and over. What behooves a Christian and a gentleman? And Lee wanted, that's why he fought Gettysburg. He wanted to be a gentleman. Now, say whatever we want. Maybe it's stupid to be a gentleman. And can gentlemen really fight in a war? And can a gentleman ever win a war? And Lee didn't win a war. But you think about it for a minute. When it was all said and done, and Grant and Lee met at Appomattox Courthouse and ended the war, Grant allowed Lee's troops to carry home their weapons. Based on what? Based on the fact that Robert E. Lee promised Grant that war would end. Can you imagine? Can you imagine us going in to fight over with Saddam and Hussein and all these guys and backing Hussein up against the wall and Saddam saying, all right, listen, we surrender. If you let us keep our nukes and our weapons and let these men carry them, carry their guns, nothing's going to happen. It's all not a chance. But when Lee told Grant, my men will cease their actions against the North, the war is over, Grant let them keep their weapons, their sidearms, and their horses. You say, what was that? It's a man of honor. It's a man of honor. So much so that Grant would trust in the leader of his own enemies and take his word. You can't even go and buy a car now on your word. And yet Lee could keep the weapons in the hands of the enemy just by a handshake and a promise. And I won't read all the rest of that. There's a lot there. Let me read you a letter that he wrote to his son, give you an idea of what he felt. Robert E. Lee wrote a letter to his son that became famous. Douglas MacArthur wrote a letter, his son became famous. And they had a lot of thoughts about them that were the same. He says, you must study to be frank with the world. Frankness is the child of honesty and courage. Say just what you mean to do on every occasion and take it for granted that you mean to do right. If a friend asks a favor, you should grant it if it is reasonable. If not, tell him plainly why you cannot. You would wrong him and wrong yourself by equivocation of any kind. Never do a wrong thing to make a friend or to keep one. The man who requires you to do so is dearly purchased at the sacrifice. Deal kindly but firmly with all your classmates. You will find it the policy which wears best. Above all, do not appear to others what you are not. If you have any fault to find with anyone, tell him, not others, of what you complain. There is no more dangerous experiment than that of undertaking to be one thing before a man's face and another behind his back. We should live, act, and say nothing to the injury of anyone. It is not only for the best as a matter of principle, but is the path of peace and honor. In regard to duty, let me, in conclusion of this hasty letter, inform you that nearly 100 years ago, there was a day of remarkable gloom and darkness, still known as the Dark Day, when the day of the light of the sun was slowly extinguished, as if by an eclipse. The legislature of Connecticut was in session, and its members saw the unexpected and unaccountable darkness coming on. They shared in general awe and terror. It was supposed by many that the last day, the day of judgment, had come. Someone, in the consternation of the hour, moved an adjournment. Then there arose an old Puritan legislator, Davenport of Stamford, and said that if the last day had come, he desired to be found at his place doing his duty, and therefore moved that candles be brought in so the house could proceed with its duty. There was a quietness in that man's mind, the quietness of heavenly wisdom and inflexible willingness to obey present duty. Duty, then, is the sublimest word. You cannot do more. You should never wish to do less. Never let your mother or me wear one gray hair for any lack of duty on your part. Do good, teach unto your children. That's Robert E. Lee. Now, the North had some godly people and some godly ideals. Maybe that's why this was a war of honor overall. But some of the things that were passed, and I'll give you some ideas here very briefly. I read one to you a week or so ago. Remember the proclamation that Lincoln placed in effect? This is a executive order, November 15, 1862. I'll just quote part of it. The importance for man and beast of the prescribed weekly rest, the sacred rights of Christian soldiers and sailors, of becoming deference to the best sentiment of a Christian people, and the due regard in the Army and Navy be reduced to the measure of strict necessity. The discipline and character of the national forces should not suffer, nor the cause they defend be imperiled by the profanation of the day or the name of the Most High. Now, what is this talking about? He's talking about declaring the Sabbath day a day of rest among his troops. At this time of public distress, adopting the words of Washington in 1776, quote, men may find enough to do in the service of God and their country without abandoning themselves to vice and immorality, unquote. The first general order issued by the father of this country after the Declaration of Independence indicates the spirit in which our institutions were founded and should ever be defended. That's an interesting comment. People say America was never a Christian nation. Lincoln thought it was, and he thought so because of what Washington said. The general hopes and trusts that every officer and man will endeavor to live and act as becomes a Christian soldier, defending the dearest rights and liberties of his country, signed Abraham Lincoln, November 15, 1862. This is the one I read. This is a proclamation of a national fast day, March the 30th, 1863. Just read some of the body of this to you. Whereas it is the duty of nations as well as of men to own their own dependence upon the overruling power of God, to confess their sins and transgressions in humble sorrow, yet with assured hope that genuine repentance will lead to mercy and pardon, and to recognize the sublime truth announced in the Holy Scriptures and proven by all history, that those nations only are blessed whose God is the Lord. Can you imagine Congress today writing something like this? And inasmuch as we know that by his divine law, nations, like individuals, are subjected to punishments and chastisements in this world, may we not justly fear that the awful calamity of civil war, which now desolates the land, may be but a punishment inflicted upon us for our presumptuous sins to the needful end of our national reformation as a whole people? What did he say? He just said the reason may be that we're in this civil war because of our sins and a need to confess and make them right. We have been the recipients of the choicest bounties of heavens. We have been preserved these many years in peace and prosperity. We have grown in numbers, wealth, and power as no other nation has ever grown, but we have forgotten God. We have forgotten the gracious hand which preserved us in peace, multiplied and enriched and strengthened us. We have vainly imagined in the deceitfulness of our hearts that all these blessings were produced by some superior wisdom and virtue of our own. Intoxicated with unbroken success, we have become too self-sufficient to feel the necessity of redeeming and persevering grace, too proud to pray to the God that made us. It behooves us then to humble ourselves before the offended power, to confess our national sins, and to pray for clemency and forgiveness. That's Abraham Lincoln, 1863. We go on and on and on with this. I've got a bunch of these papers. And I'll not read them all this morning. Thomas Jefferson, a slaveholder, talking about how to rid yourself of the institution of slavery. He quotes Jefferson and makes the application. Thomas Jefferson, a slaveholder, mindful of the moral element in slavery, solemnly declared that he trembled for his country when he remembered that God is just. That's what Jefferson's ideals were. He realized that slavery was an immoral institution and God someday would get even. And that may have been what the Civil War was all about. I don't know. If we'd gone as missionaries to Africa rather than as slave traders, if we'd brought people to Christ rather than bringing them to chains, we might have had a different outcome or a different outlook in our nation. I don't know. But I do know this, that the Civil War, if you want to understand it correctly, was not fought over the issue of slavery, but over the issue of states' rights and the rights of the federal government to interrupt or dispose of those states' rights. And I also know that the bitterness that is experienced in the South for the North was not a result of something that happened prior to the Civil War, but what happened from mid-Civil War and through the Reconstruction days. And that bitterness exists not as a result of losing the war, but as a result of being humiliated and embarrassed even years after the war. And that came about as a result of that. All right, any questions this morning? That is a one-hour overview on the Civil War. And I apologize for going so hurriedly, but there are a lot of events in there. And again, for those of you visiting, you didn't get much Bible this morning. Didn't intend for you to. The new government of this country has designed the Reformation history now be taught in schools and high schools, colleges, and of what I gave you this morning, probably less than a third would ever be taught in any institution in America, because anything that deals with God or Christianity cannot be taught now.